profit from this next hour of study here in 1 Peter, in our analysis of verse 18 and 19. Peter is bringing forth the doctrine of salvation under his terms of redemption to remind these believers in regards to the importance of their conduct of pursuing God's plus R. The cost that Jesus Christ rendered in order that we may attain to this end. And he first tells us and reminds us of the doctrine at hand, a doctrine that we should know. In verse 18, knowing that you were not redeemed with perishable things like silver or gold from your futile way of life inherited from your forefathers. Peter makes very clear that these physical, tangible things, even as valuable as silver and gold, what that might provide for us in time, do nothing to deliver men from their spiritual dilemma, spiritual death, and the absolute rulership of the STA in their lives, and that nothing tangible is able to do so because tangible things are perishable. And that which is redeemed at the point of saving faith is the very soul of the individual, which is eternal and imperishable. And therefore, that which is perishable does not have the equal value necessary for the redemption or paying the price to deliver the individual's eternal soul from this eternal condemnation and plight under spiritual death. And the futile way of life inherited from their fathers harks back to these early Gentile believers who, in vast majority, at least, if not all, came from a pagan background of religiosity and grew up under this philosophy and approach in regards to their lives of what is necessary to secure the good life hereafter. And it denotes all those, under normal circumstances, children who grew up under their parents, embracing their parents' ideas and philosophies in life, including their religious approach. And that if it is remiss of the true gospel of salvation and faith in Jesus Christ in this respect, then anything and everything that they have learned otherwise, the human viewpoint, etc., is completely worthless. And all these things were a dead end in regards to their thinking. And this is one thing that, as parents, you should remember, and that is that your life, your thinking, will have a direct impact upon your children, and that they will continue, they will grow up and seek to emulate and mimic, if not embrace, your very approach to life and all that you think, say, and do. And obviously to ensure that you do not pass on a spiritual inheritance that is vain and worthless. It demands that the parent itself embrace Bible doctrine and pass this heritage, this spiritual heritage, onto their children. Otherwise, they, as these early pagan believers, will have to come out of this camp of futility in order to embrace the truth later on in their lives. But that's the normal aspect of growing up in life, of inheriting ideas and thoughts, etc., and life itself and ideas from our parents. And for many of us, obviously, we have had to separate in order to our own thinking, etc., in order to come to grips with the truth of Bible doctrine in contrast to the fallacious notions that were handed to us beforehand. Then in verse 19 here, where we're dealing with, Peter reveals the only acceptable tender or coin that is able to deliver mankind from the slave market of sin, and that is, as Christ is likened metaphorically here, but with precious blood, as of a lamb unblemished and spotless, the blood of Christ. Redemption looks basically to a deliverance, but in its fullest definition, theologically, it includes a ransom or a price or a thing of value that is paid to purchase one from slavery or a plight or condition that they're otherwise in to secure their freedom for a better life. And that is the fullness of the sense. And while Peter emphasized first and foremost for what men are delivered from in freedom, and that's the futility of human viewpoint, cosmic thinking in regards to God, now he gives us the price, the actual ransom that has been made. Point 57, the strong adversity. Allah emphasizes the stark contrast between any physical attempts to secure salvation with the spiritual reality. That which is futile is nothing but energy of the flesh, relative righteousness as it may apply in regards to our salvation. So 58, Peter clearly employs imagery that parallels Old Testament sacrifice here. 59, the ransom, the coin, the tender, that which is viable currency to pay a debt. See, as being under spiritual debt, with an STA, we're in spiritual debt to God. And what we're in debt is in regards to God's righteousness, because we're less than His righteousness. We are not absolutely righteous. So the ransom here that for redemption is described as the precious blood of Christ. 60, Christ is then likened to a lamb unblemished and spotless, which is based on Old Testament typology of the Levitical sacrifices. 61, the term lamb is used only three other times in the New Testament and always in reference to Christ. So this term in the New Testament takes on a technical usage, and that is in reference to Jesus Christ, and that is the imagery of the type of which was represented as his person in the Old Testament, here specifically in regards to the Passover lamb. And that's point 62. This key word has as its Old Testament antecedent the Passover lamb, suffering lamb. 63, Israel's deliverance from Egyptian bondage was predicated upon their participation in the first Passover observed in Egypt, as we read that passage in Exodus 12, chapter 12. And in order to finally get Pharaoh to humble himself to deliver the Jews, God instituted the first ritual of Passover, the sacrifice of the Passover lamb. And all the Jews were commanded to take the lamb and obviously cut its carotid artery to bleed it to death. And they would take some of the blood, put it on the doorposts and lintels of their homes, which faced the outside. And they were to then roast the lamb. They couldn't boil it. That denotes that the judgment of the sacrifice, the sacrificial lamb, of what it represented, typologically or shadowed, as the judgment of Jesus Christ's body, as the sins of the world in his body, and to partake of that lamb indicates their faith in regards to this person. And by doing so, God would pass over the judgment that he was going to provide upon the otherwise negative Egyptians, which was death of the firstborn, including all of the firstborn of their livestock. And their deliverance, obviously, to escape their own death, for God to not stop at their house and bring this judgment upon them, is that they participated as God had so instructed. So 64, Paul understood this significance of sacrifice within Old Testament history in his shadow Christology and soteriology, that means salvation, study of salvation. When he spoke of quote, Christ, our Passover, also has been sacrificed in 1 Corinthians 5:7. So, 65, Christ is the reality. The Old Testament taught this reality, but the reality had not come until Jesus Christ appeared on this planet. And he, therefore, Paul understood the spiritual significance of what the Old Testament taught in this regard and applies it to the reality itself, who is Jesus Christ, the true Paschal or Passover suffering lamb. 66, where we left off, under the law, Mosaic law, all sacrificial animals had to fulfill the requirement of perfection. 67, under no circumstances could an animal be used for sacred purposes that had a detectable flaw or imperfection. That was part of the requirements if you're going to utilize a particular animal in regards to the Old Testament sacrifice. They had to meet certain requirements, obviously, physically. So 68, birth defects, disease, or injury rendered otherwise qualified animal sacrifices unacceptable. Well, they might be the type of animal you need, like a lamb, goat, bull, pigeon, whatever. If they had physical defects, then you had to throw that one out and get you another one. Leviticus 22. Brings this principle out here. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron, to his sons, to all the sons of Israel, and say to them, any man of the house of Israel or of the aliens in Israel who presents his offering, that offering is sacrifice, whether it is one of their votive or any of their free will offerings, which they present to the Lord for a burnt offering, for you to be accepted, it must be a male. That was one qualification. It would be female. That represents that Messiah was going to be a man. Without defect from the cattle, the sheep, or the goats. Whatever has a defect, you shall not offer, for it will not be accepted for you. And when a man offers a sacrifice, a peace offering to the Lord to fulfill a special vow, or for a free will offering, of the herd or of the flock, it must be perfect to be accepted. There shall be no defect in it. Those that are blind or fractured or maimed or having a running sore or eczema or scabs, you shall not offer to the Lord, nor make of them an offering by fire on the altar to the Lord. In respect to an ox or a lamb which has an overgrown or stunted member, and the language here looks at slight deformities, such as maybe the ears are not equally proportioned or size, the eyes might be off a little bit, etc. But otherwise, the animal is without any further defect. You may present it for a free will offering on your behalf, but for a vow, a votive offering, which obviously is going to represent the person of Jesus Christ, specifically in his presentation, it shall not be accepted. Also, anything with his testicles bruised or crushed or torn or cut, you shall not offer to the Lord or sacrifice in your land. Nor shall you accept any such from the hand of a foreigner for offering. It doesn't make any difference who's doing this. So this is the rules. As the food of your God, for their corruption is in them, they have a defect, they shall not be accepted for you. So these things, the animal that was provided in regards to the sacrifice physically, had to be without blemish or perfect. No deformities, no illnesses ascribed to it, healthy, etc. So that was part of the law, and this also taught in regards to the reality of Jesus Christ. So 69, Peter here uses two adjectives to describe Christ's qualifications as a reality of the type. A lamb unblemished and spotless. He's likened to a lamb as such. The first adjective here, point 70, homomos, means physically without blemish or defect. And more metaphorically, moral blamelessness or without fault. 71, the second adjective, spotless, aspidos, in the Greek, means without stain, pure or uncorrupted. And again, more metaphorically, of moral purity. 72, the particular adjective, spotless, indicates a disqualification from an external association. In other words, to get a spot or stain, like on your clothing, someone, you know, dumping a glass of wine, that comes from an external association. And that's the emphasis and difference between these two adjectives. Spotless denotes it cannot be contaminated by anything externally. So 73, the first adjective, implies Jesus was born physically without an SGA, while the second denotes neither did he succumb to external temptation. Again, all mankind are born into this world spiritually dead, possessing a sin nature. And that renders us helpless, because we are immediately introduced into debt to God because we have minus R accounted against us. And the SCA is that which has rulership over our lives until that rulership, in an absolute sense, obviously, is broken. And what set Jesus Christ apart and what first qualified him is the fact that he was born without a sin nature, just as Adam and Eve were created without one. And this was a necessity in order to provide this coin necessary in payment of the sin debt of mankind to God, to redeem us in this respect. So the first adjective implies Jesus was born physically without an SCA. Then on top of it, well, the second denotes neither did he succumb to eternal temptation. Jesus Christ came into a hostile environment. And obviously, he was tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. So while we have to fight on two fronts in regards to temptation from within as well as without, Jesus Christ simply had to avoid overt temptation and not succumb to sin or disobedience to God in that respect. So 74, in order to qualify as a sacrificial lamb, Christ's humanity had to be both inherently pure, minus the indwelling SCA, and remain sinless throughout his life. 75, just as a sacrificial animal had to be without physical defect, so Jesus had to be inherently pure, morally. 76, now the mechanics for Christ to be born this way. How was this made possible? Since, obviously, through procreation, every child that comes into this world inherits genetic sin nature, our flesh, in this respect, which has been the reality since the fall of Adam and Eve in the garden. Well, for Jesus Christ, how God provided his humanity a way of avoiding the sin nature. 76, the mechanics for Christ to be born in this way was through the virgin birth. Matthew 1, 23 through 25 tells us that Jesus Christ was born of a virgin, of a female who had never had sexual intercourse with another man, even though she was betrothed at this point in time to Joseph. Matthew 1, 23 through 25. Behold, the virgin shall be with child and shall bear a son. They shall call his name Emmanuel, which translated means God with us. Joseph arose from his sleep and did as angel the Lord commanded him and took her as his wife to protect her reputation. And kept her a virgin until she gave birth to a son. they never was able to consummate that marriage physically until after the birth of Christ and his humanity. And he called his name Jesus. So the principle that can be logically deduced in regards to the sin nature is that the male, the father, is the transmitter of the sin nature gene. The mother is simply a carrier. Now all are infected because, if you will, in regards to sin nature, all acquire sin nature, whether male or female, because it takes the mother and father coming together, coming together to produce this living organism known as a baby, this flesh. And it looks at the fact that the woman, during a period of gestation, produces one ovum that is minus the sin nature gene. But when it comes together with the male sperm, which has the sin nature gene, obviously it develops the entire fetus with the sin nature. So the man is the transmitter of the sin nature, of the STA, where the woman is simply a carrier, and hence why the virgin birth must occur. People think, well, that's cool. Well, there's a reason for it, and it's for this very reason, so that Jesus Christ would be able to at least get off the ground with running opportunity to qualify himself as being blameless and spotless. He could not have sin against him. And the fact he was born without a sin nature, he was not under the judgment of Adam's original sin, which is imputed to each sin nature that comes into this world. And he was born, therefore, spiritually alive. And that means that Jesus Christ was born with a human spirit. All men come in this world in the form of dichotomy of only two parts, the soul and the body. The believer, when they believe in Jesus Christ, become trichotomous. They now have a new human spirit that's given to them. Well, Jesus came into this world trichotomous, and he had no sin accounted against him, and he had no sin nature. And therefore, he was born a free man, in contrast to the rest of us who are born into the slavery of the sin nature, sin itself, in this regard. So 77, this allowed him to be born with a human spirit that is created as absolutely righteous. And again, in our previous doctrine of regeneration, which looks at the believer being given a human spirit, Ephesians 4:24 tells us that it's created, God creates the human spirit in righteousness, in the spirit of righteousness. That's God's righteousness. Not relative righteousness, but absolute righteousness and truth. So you have to take doctrine, pieces of the puzzle, and put it together in order to have a clear picture of what's going on. So 78, now further, in hypostatic union, so the fact that Christ came into this world without a sin nature, and he was essentially qualified as plus R at that point in time. God the Son obviously was able to condescend and come into union with his humanity and have union with this type of humanity that's free of sin or sin nature. But in addition, to maintain the hypostatic union, to maintain this mysterious and yet wonderful union, the second person of the Godhead with the humanity of Jesus Christ, one must understand that Christ's humanity was temptable, point 78, incapable of sinning. In other words, he had free will. This is the true doctrine of impeccability. It is a recognition that Jesus Christ could have, of his own free choice, he had free will, could have disobeyed God. But he didn't. The dominant doctrine of impeccability states that Jesus Christ could not sin. You can't find me any place in the Bible that says that. It says he did not sin. And then you got clear verses, such as John 5:30, that declares that his humanity had will. And again, that's just an important thing to understand. It really, if you will, should elevate your appreciation for the soul of Jesus Christ and his humanity and what he truly accomplished on this planet. And that is, God creates all with free will, all his creation. He did not create a robot to save us. He created humanity that did it on his own accord in regards to his own choice in life. And John 5:30, Christ declares, I can do nothing on my own initiative. Not if he wants to maintain his status as Messiah. Not if he wants to continue to present himself in the hypostatic union. As I hear, I judge. And what does he hear? God's word. God's plan for his life. And he makes the decisions. And my judgment is just because it comes from God. He follows God exactly. Why? Because I do not seek my own will. That verse clearly declares that Jesus Christ's humanity had will. Obviously, deity has will, but his will of his deity was sovereign. But Jesus Christ and his humanity, you must understand where Jesus Christ is coming from in regards to expressions of himself in the New Testament, whether it is coming from his humanity or from his deity or from both. And he did not, this because he did not seek my own will, but the will of him who sent me. Other than the sovereignty, obviously, of his deity, and obviously of God the Father, emphasis in regards to his being the architect of the plan and the head authority of Godhead. So, the true doctrine of impeccability is the marvelous aspect with free will Jesus Christ chose never to sin. And by that we mean he chose never to disobey God in any aspect of his life. People need to understand the true definition of sin. Sin simply means miss the mark of God's righteousness. To miss the mark, that's what it means. Miss the mark. And what when one sins, you miss the mark of God's righteousness. You disobey his directive will in this regard. Now, that meant that Jesus Christ had to keep the law perfectly, adhere to all the sacrifices and everything that we're all teaching about him. He had to do all that. Plus, morally, obviously, he had to remain pure and faultless before God. So, to me, I always heard that Jesus couldn't sin in the fundamentalist world. But when I recognize that principle, I go, wow. You know, you think about yourself. You think about how willful are you in regards to keeping your STA overruled. How easy does your will succumb? As the writer of Hebrews so states, which one of you has suffered or avoided temptation to the point of shedding blood? Looking at Jesus Christ on the night before his crucifixion, the pressure that was on his soul in regards to going to the cross and being Messiah. No one. No one ever has except for him. In regards to, especially when it comes to temptation or sin. And that validates our premise in regards to the fact that none of us would have done any better in regard our souls, our wills are weak in the face of temptation. That's just how powerful Satan is. But out of the tree of souls, God knew that there was one that could do it. That's the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. So in hypostatic union, Christ's humanity was temptable and capable of sinning. He was tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. So 79, he could have followed the pattern of Adam and sinned apart from his sin nature. Now Jesus in the book of Romans is likened to the second Adam. Adam was a type of Christ. But Adam did something that got mankind into the dilemma that we are spiritually in our fallen state. Jesus Christ reversed that process. He undid it. And Adam and Eve, they were created without a sin nature. They were created trichotomous. Genesis says that it is breathed, that God gave Adam the breath of life, Chayim in the Hebrew. That's plural. That's soul life, providing physical life, and spiritual life, the human spirit. And obviously, they were without an SCA, but they were placed in a hostile environment. Now, the creation around it, that was perfect in the restoration and being in the garden. There was an adversary loose on the planet. And this is the beginning of the angelic conflict. And Satan was there, and as we know, he was free to tempt Adam and Eve. Plus the fact that they were given one law that they could not transgress, and that's eating of the good of tree and evil. And it was all a test in regards to volition. And it really shows something in regards to will. And apart from having a sin nature, Eve, under deception, allowed Satan to tempt her and bring her to the conclusion that it's all right to eat of the tree, and she in turn turned around to Adam and tempted him, and while she did it in ignorance, if you will, or being deceived, Adam did it with full cognizance, knowing that it was wrong. Eve fell also, and both of them disobeyed God, and they did it without a sin nature. But that's how the sin nature then came into existence. This trend of disobedience away from God under the attack of evil and under that pressure in life. And I'm here to tell you, our SCA is a constant reminder of what our will and soul is. As Paul said it, and I've stated it, we've read it in Romans, the very thing that I wish I don't do. His very desire, his soul desire, understanding the power of the sin nature. And while the flesh is called the weakness, the true weakness comes from your soul determining to let it have its way when you put it down and button it down. So, again, food for thought. And Jesus Christ, obviously, even though he didn't have the sin nature, still had to abstain from the hostile environment, the enemy of the world around him in this way. And that Adam's original sin was committed in the absence of the sin nature. So 81, without the indwelling SCA, Jesus' humanity came into this world qualified as plus R. See, when we come into the world, the sin counted against us, we're immediately designated as minus R. We're less than perfect in regards to God's righteousness. We have sin accounted against us. The evidence that we have that sin nature doesn't take long to express itself in that regard. And obviously, all coming into this world with sin accounted against us in possession of the sin nature, and we're minus R. And Jesus, by avoiding a sin nature, was able to come into the world. His humanity immediately starts off as qualified as plus R. Now it's up to him in his life to maintain that. We thank God he did. So without the indwelling STA, Jesus' humanity came into this world qualified as plus R. 62, this allowed him to avoid temptation from within, not having the STA, unblemished, if you will, in the adjectives used here by Peter. And that he was spotless declares he avoided temptation from without. He maintained his plus R. I compare 1 Peter 2:22. For you have all been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. Quoting from Isaiah 53:9, 1 John 3:5. And you know that he appeared in order to take away sins, and in him there is no sin. So 83, any sin would have disqualified him as a sacrifice for the sins of the world. 84, he would have died spiritually, prematurely, forfeiting his human spirit, as happened to Adam. The consequence of disobedience to God, God told Adam straight up, you do this, dying you will die. And the Lord commanded the man, saying, from any tree of the garden you may eat freely. Genesis 2:16, but from the tree of knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. For in that day that you eat from it, literally, dying, you will die. So what occurred in regard to the garden is that immediately upon disobedience of God, they underwent spiritual death. Adam didn't die physically until some 930 years later. So two deaths occurred. And if Jesus Christ had engaged in one act of sin, one act of disobedience to God's will, he too, his humanity, would have died spiritually in salvation. Look out. It's been gone. But that's not the way it happened, is it? God foreknew what would happen. How much do we owe it? So that's the whole emphasis of this whole verse. How much do we owe it? You think a call to be holy and righteous in your life is a call that's, you know, beyond your scope of willpower in order to try to endure and obtain to? But you need to think about what Jesus Christ did so that you could have that privilege and that right, this kind of relationship with God. Now I'm taking Peter's verse and putting it in this intent. So 85, Old Testament animal sacrifice required the death of the animal through the shedding of blood. And continuing on in the typology, the teaching in regards to sacrifice, how the animal, when they were sacrificed, it required that the person cut their carotid artery and in the throat and let the animal bleed out. And it's called shedding of blood. And that's the life source of our animals. They don't have a soul. They're a lower creation. Only higher creation has a soul. Even though men act like animals. So the Old Testament animal sacrifice required the death of the animal through the shedding of blood. 86, the Passover lamb's blood, again, as from our Exodus passage, had to be applied to lintels and doorposts as Israelite dwellings for the people to escape death at the first Passover. That denotes that through Jesus Christ's blood is the only way to salvation. Literally. So, 87, while the Lamb portrays Christ, the shed blood of the Lamb portrays Christ's work towards sin on the cross. Again, as Paul refers to the Old Testament typology of 1 Corinthians 5:7, Christ, our Passover, also has been sacrificed. So while the Lamb portrays Christ, the shed blood of the Lamb portrays Christ's work for sin on the cross. 88, all animal victims sacrificed bled to death under the knife, which blood was their life source. So the only kind of life they had to give was this physical blood life. Leviticus 17:11 tells us this fact. For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you on the altar to make atonement for your souls. Redemption of the souls. For it is the blood by reason of the life. That's what the blood represents, is life that makes atonement. And here, obviously, we're dealing with spiritual life. And what is Jesus Christ's spiritual life? It's his human spirit. That's what gives him spiritual life. 89, the writer of Hebrews teaches that the literal blood of animal sacrifice does not save. Hebrews 10:1-4. For the law, since it was only a shadow of the good things to come, see, a type, a shadow, that's what typology is, a shadow. You can't see the exact details. What you see is his image, and what, therefore, what it looks like, etc. The law is only a shadow of the good things to come and not the very form of things. It's not the reality. Can they ever buy the same sacrifices year by year, which they offer, as was according to the Mosaic law? Made perfect those who draw near. The writer of Hebrews is stating, and this is in direct apologetics in regards to mainline Judaism, thinking that keeping the law, sacrifices, these literal things is what saved them. And he says, these things can't be done. They're done every year. What does that mean? Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered? If it had its true impact of forgiving sins, then why did God keep telling you have to keep on doing this? See? Because the worshipers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have had consciousness of sins. But in those sacrifices, there is a reminder of sins year by year. The STA, the need for salvation, that one cannot attain to God's standard of holiness. For it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. Therefore, when He, Jesus Christ, comes into the world, He says, sacrifice and offering you have not desired in regards to the aspects of animal sacrifice in the Mosaic law. That was not what God was desiring in regards to effectuating salvation. It's simply a teaching aid in this respect. But the body you have prepared for me, as He is the substitute, the reality, and the whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin, you have taken no pleasure. And I said, behold, I have come, I have arrived, in the roll of the book, it is written of me, to do your will, O God. So literal blood, first and foremost, as the writer of Hebrews makes clear, in regards to the animal sacrifices, does not save. It's not the physical that is being emphasized in regards to sacrifices. It's the spiritual, the reality that would obviously follow that it taught about. And in the sentence with a preposition. 90. The blood of Christ does not refer to his physical blood. As he, in contrast to the animal sacrifice of the Old Testament, did not bleed to death on the cross. That's how they died. They were bled out. And Jesus Christ did not bleed to death on the cross. 91, Jesus Christ is not a literal lamb or bull or ram. Obviously, the fundamentalists, they accept that. Well, no, he's not a literal lamb. He's called the Lamb of God. So his shed blood is not literal in the saving us from sins. There's so many things. On the other side of the coin, when it comes to talk about the blood of Christ, their emotions totally run rampant over their lives and their thinking. And they say, oh, it's literal blood. I remember on the internet several years ago, some conversation with a fundy and some things I was saying, and he's grinning, oh man, that's great, blah, blah. And I said something about a spiritual death. What? You don't believe in the literal blood that Jesus saves you? And they start calling you an unbeliever. I didn't think I was saved. Well, I used to think that's what I'm saying anyway. But anyway, I did. Just gave him the verses. Gave him the verses. And again, that's just stems from emotionalism. A lack of sound teaching is what it stems from. A lack of desire to hear it. His shed blood. It's not literal. It's not the literal blood of Jesus Christ that saves us. 92, the blood of Christ is a representative analogy, not a direct analogy. 93, sacrificial animal blood versus Christ's blood is not an X equals X proposition, but X equals Y. Just as the lamb is X equals Y. So is his blood. 94, the animal bleeding to death equals Christ's work bearing sins, specifically, from 12 noon to 3 p.m., as he is on the cross for 6 hours, from 9 to 3. So 95, fact, Christ did not die by bleeding to death. Even medical science has looked at the information given in regards to biblical documentation of his death. 96, in fact, he did bleed through wounds inflicted by men both prior to and during his crucifixion. It is. So he didn't die bleeding to death. So obviously, it did not demand the entirety of his literal blood to save the world, looking at it in apologetics against those who want to take this literally. Now, he did bleed under persecution. The Roman soldiers beforehand, putting the crowns on his head, his whipping, because a lot of times these families will come back and say, well, it just took one drop of blood to save you. Well, why the rigors of crucifixion then? Why didn't God just, you know, have him back into a cactus and prick his finger and a little drop of blood come out? Of course, they can't answer that. They look at you like you're blasphemous because you might bring up a question like that. But these are all the facts. These are the facts that are recorded for us. So he did bleed through wounds inflicted by men both prior to and during his crucifixion. They were not efficacious in regards to sin bearing. They were just part of the suffering in his humanity that he had to endure in order to be qualified for when these 3 hours came up. So 97, in fact, there was ample blood remaining in his body, same life when he actually died. 98, in fact, after he had died, a Roman soldier pierced his side, out came blood and water, or serum, which is an indication that he still had ample blood in his body. John 19:34, as we obviously have been through this before when we did the Gospel of John, as well as inferences elsewhere in our studies. But one of the soldiers pierced his side with the sword, and immediately there came out blood and serum, or water. 99, fact. Christ died of his own free will, as he prophesied he would, and not as a result of the trauma of crucifixion. He was unique even in his physical death. Part of, if you will, grace afforded his humanity for being successful and offering himself as a sacrifice is that God permitted his deity upon completion of that to check out his humanity. So even in his physical death, it was unique. People think the cross killed him. No, God killed him. He killed himself, if you will, in that sense, through his deity. He just checked out his humanity. It wasn't suicide. It was time to go. God was calling him home. Obviously, deity took him out, did he not? So it wasn't suicide from his humanity. So I'm trying to throw that out at you. Luke 23:46. And Jesus, crying out with a loud voice, said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. That's a proclamation. I'm out of here. Which one of you, you know, just like the Indians, you like to see some of the programmed Indians, you know, they think it's time to die and they have this contact with their great God in the sky. I'm out of here. Some people may say they might die a little bit after that. Jesus Christ, you know, talking about making a proclamation. I'm out of here. Into your hands, Father, I commit my spirit. He's gone. And as he said this, he breathed his last. Is that control over your life or what? Confer John 10:17-18. For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life in order that I might take it up again. He's the one. I lay down my life, see. No one has taken it away from me, but I lay it down on my own initiative. I have authority to lay it down. God gave him the authority and the right to do this. And I have authority to take it up again. This commandment I received from my Father. And then Matthew 27:15. Jesus cried out with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. He yielded it up. turned it over to his deity, over to God. So 100, all references to the blood of Christ relate to the three-hour time frame on the cross when he bore the sins of mankind as marked off by the darkness that engulfed the area. That was a key indication when God turned at least the area. Maybe did this whole world well. We don't know that. But in that particular area, he made it dark. He kind of turned out the lights. Why? To give Jesus Christ his privacy in this next 3 hours. Matthew 27:45. Now the sixth hour, that would be noon, darkness fell upon all the land until the ninth hour. So the efficacious work of Jesus Christ and the sin bearing actually occurred. The sins were being judged and redemption was being made, occurred during this 3 hour period. And the darkness is that which is a clue that sets us off when these things are going on, when this is going on. So at 101, at the end of the 3 hours, he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? That's verse 46. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's giving an indication that during this period of darkness, that in some sense, God is separated from him. And that denotes that fellowship is broken. God, in regards to his humanity, is rhetorical. I mean, God hasn't forsaken him. 102, following three more sayings from the cross, woman, behold your son, that he told to John, the author of John's Gospel and the Epistles, or to Mary, his mother, behold your mother, that's back to John. Then he said, I am thirsty. The three statements after that, taking care of the finalities before he exited out of here, see. And obviously, the fact that he is thirsty would be a natural response of what his humanity had endured. These are all recorded for us in John 19:26, 27, 28. After that, he proclaimed, it is finished. John 19:30. What's finished? What's finished? Sin bearing. Sin bearing. To me, it's amazing that he still had the wherewithal to deal with still the immediate issues in regards to his relationship to his mother before he left. And that's pretty spectacular. Most of us, he endured 3 hours and just on the cross, let alone 3 hours of direct judgment by God in your body and the pain and everything that went with that. We'd be passed out or whatever. Our body's gone out of here. Jesus Christ, by all appearances, retained consciousness throughout all of this. Now, you want an example of will? It's kind of will that Jesus Christ and humanity had. They had the forbearance, the presence of mind. So 103, what was finished was his sin bearing during the 3 hours and broken fellowship with the Father as implied in Matthew 27:46. Why you forsaken me? 104, while enshrouded under the privacy of darkness, Christ's humanity experienced judgment directly from the hand of God as a ransom for the sins of all mankind. 105, that Christ's blood is defined as precious, which is timios, indicates that what he sacrificed was extremely costly. 106, the tender of his ransom, the coin, used to pay the Father as he accepted the judgment of sins for the whole world in his body was through the agency of his human spirit. 107, this is implied in the Hebrews 9:14, which I give you a corrected translation. In my Bible, it shows a corrected translation as an alternative. How much more will the blood of Christ, who through his eternal spirit, you can look at it in regards to the New American Standard otherwise, they say, who through the eternal spirit, they want to make it God the Holy Spirit. they try to translate it. I mean, they try to interpret this verse rather than just translate it. It's through an eternal spirit. And the alternative to that is his eternal spirit, which in my Bible, it has that reckoned down below. Who through his eternal spirit, that's dia, pneumatos, ionion, his eternal spirit, offered himself without blemish to God. And that is the correct interpretation of that verse. That's interpreting the verse the way it's supposed to be. It's looking at his eternal spirit. That's the agency of his blood. That's his spiritual life. He underwent, during this period of time, spiritual death. In so doing, his human spirit was separated from his soul, body, of which the human spirit interfaces with the soul, all indications in the scripture. Because it goes with us when we go to heaven, apart from our body. And he gave that payment to God. That was his token. That was his coin. His plus R. That was evidence of his plus R. He said, here it is. And his body is left wide open for the judgment of God's, for the judgment by God's hand directly for the sins of the world, of which his body then underwent all the physical pain and trauma associated with that aspect of his judgment. But the token that he gave to God was his plus R in the presence of his human spirit. So, 108, Jesus' human spirit is eternal, provides the eternal commodity necessary to purchase another eternal commodity, the soul. Our soul, born in this world without the human spirit. So 109, Christ sacrificed his human spirit, that was plus R. That was his precious token of his sinlessness. That was his token. That was his ransom. Undergoing voluntary spiritual death, while enduring the judgments of sin in his body as man substitutes for sins and minus R. For the judgment. So 110, Christ's work towards sin on the cross was twofold. Enduring the lashes of God's wrath in his body, rightly deserved by fallen man, 1 Peter 2:24, and paying the ultimate price of this plus R to redeem man from their spiritual bankruptcy, reversing spiritual death, and instead providing spiritual life. Time is over time, so we'll finish this short section Tuesday evening and get in our next set of verses. Father, again, we thank you for the truth of your word. We ask God's Holy Spirit to give you light to see these things.